I don't remember their marriage date. I don't recall just when they were married.
That's okay. We can fill it in later if you
Somewhere around 1909, 1910, somewhere around there. Let's see. I guess maybe later than that. Probably around 1912. It took shortly after my dad finished college.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of 10 brothers and sisters. And she was, the middle of three sisters. What else do you want?
Well, that's fine. I just wanted just a little background on her. Is she, you said her middle name was Lee. Was she any relation to the Virginia Lees? Or?
I don't know where she got that name.
Maybe someone was just fond of it. Did you have any brothers and sisters yourself?
I have one brother and one sister and one half-brother and one half-sister.
What were their names, if you would?
My brother's name is William Thomas. My sister's name is Margaret Louise. My half-brother's name is, my mother was, after my father was killed, she married some 7 or 8 years later, and she had one son by that marriage, and then an adopted daughter. Half-brother's name, and Shirley was the half-sister's name.
Mm-hmm.
Shirley was a cripple. She was confined to a nursing home in Virginia. Lee was, worked for IBM, I believe, in Houston, Texas. He was in Miami for a long while, and now he's in Texas.
And your other brother, is he still?
My other brother is retired. He worked for General Motors for many years,
mm-hmm.
and retired about 5 or 6 years ago.
Did he go in the engineering profession as well?
No, he finished high school and then apprenticed in the General Motors plant and was the lead foreman in their assembly division.
Mm-hmm. Tell me just a little bit about your early education, if you would. Just start off with grade school. What do you remember about that?
Oh, I remember quite a bit about my grade school. I attended a one-room school. One teacher taught 5 grades. And I had, I skipped one grade because I did 2 grades in 1 year. Because I had all 5 grades 4 years. So I just decided to do the work for the 4th and 5th grade the same year. And then after I finished 5th grade, the teacher's name was Mrs. Brown. Then 6th and 7th grades were taught by Miss Jackson. Who was descended out of the Jacksons.
Named Andrew, not Andrew, Stonewall Jackson.
Yeah, Stonewall Jackson group. And I had the 6th and 7th grade under her, and she was a taskmaster, I tell you. She was really tough, but I learned a lot from her. Well, I learned a great deal from both of them. And then another Miss Jackson, they hired to teach the 1st year of high school. There'd never been any high school taught in this small town, only about 300 people that lived in this mining town. And she taught 4 subjects in the 1st year of high school. English, English literature, French, and algebra. And I took those 4 courses my 1st year. And that was the year my father was killed. He was killed in December of my 1st year of high school. And then we moved to Buena Vista, Virginia, which is about 150 miles up the valley. And I went to Perry McClure High School. The last 3 years of high school, I finished that. Played football. And had great teachers. I remember quite well my my algebra teacher and my biology teacher. My biology teacher was a coach, and he was a good teacher and a good coach. He died of cancer just a year and a half ago.
So you kept in touch with him over the years.
And
sounds like
Miss Knight was our English teacher, and Miss Meadow was our algebra teacher. There's only one whose name I can't remember, and she was our French teacher. I had 3 years of French while I was in school, and I can't remember her name.
Sounds like you enjoyed your
very
school.
Much, yeah, very much.
Either
small classes. There were nine boys and one girl that graduated the year that I did.
And now you're lucky if you graduate in a class with 900.
Oh yeah.
Schools are so large. What did you do after you graduated?
I went to Virginia Tech. I had a scholarship there, and so I attended there with all military at that time, with the exception of 70, what they called out of military. We had about 1,700 students there in the cadet corps. And I studied mechanical engineering. And graduated, received a commission when I graduated. This was in 1935, and jobs were kind of hard to come by. And so I looked for some while, time after I graduated, for a job, and wasn't able to get anything right away. But I had an offer of a job. I was hitchhiking from Christiansburg, which is just outside of Blacksburg, on the main highway, US 11, to my mother's hometown. She was living in Lewistown, Pennsylvania, and I was hitchhiking up for Christmas. And a fellow offered me a job. He picked me up in Christiansburg, and he took me all the way to Harrisburg. He was going on beyond Harrisburg. He was a salesman for a steam appliance company, and he offered me a job that would pay me $15 a week, but I had to have my own car. And I didn't have the car, so I couldn't accept the job.
Was it a salesman type
job?
Yes,
it was a sales job. It was Therese Steam Appliance Company.
Obviously, that would have been tough in the middle of the Depression to try to...
But he spoke very highly of the firm, and he was doing quite well with the firm, but I couldn't take the job because I didn't have the car. So after I graduated, this was Christmas before I graduated, he offered me. So he said he'd hold a job for me if I wanted it, until I graduated. But when I graduated, I looked for a job, couldn't find anything, and so I went into the service for 3 months. So they had an officer's program for a 3 month period. So I went to Fort Monroe, Virginia for 3 months.
In the Army?
Yeah. And I was in the Coast Artillery. And I saved a little money that I could go around looking for a job, and I contacted a friend of ours a person that my dad had worked with, and he offered me a job in Palmerton, Pennsylvania. It was with the same, it was with the parent company of the company that my dad worked for, New Jersey Zinc Company of Pennsylvania. So I took a job there at 50 cents an hour, which wasn't bad for that time, because room and board for $7.50 a week. And Pennsylvania Dutch family that had a boarding house and the best food you'd ever want.
I couldn't do it. And so I worked there a little over a year. And while I was there, I worked as a draftsman. And I worked in the accounting office for a short while. And then they put me out on a construction job in the middle of the wintertime. And boy, it was cold. It was 15 degrees below zero some mornings when we'd go to work. And a couple feet of snow on the ground, and they're working outside a construction job. And I had an opportunity to come to Florida then, so I accepted that to get out of the cold weather.
Where did you come? What part of Florida?
To Palm Beach County.
That was quite a change, wasn't it?
Quite a change. Particularly since I went from a town of about 8,000 people to a little settlement of Loctahatchee, which had maybe 20 or 30 people there.
Yeah.
A friend of mine had purchased 20 acres of land there, and had started a poultry farm. And I was asked to come down to assist on the farm. And it sounded pretty good. It sounded pretty good. I could make as much money as I was making.
Doing drafting.
Doing drafting and running construction in Pennsylvania. So I came down and managed the farm for until 1941.
Had you had any previous farm experience?
No. I tell everybody I did engineering for fun and raised poultry for a living because I built houses and did some drainage work and generally helped other people around the area. Actually, I didn't get any money for the help that I gave other people. We trade things
work.
Back and forth, did barter more than anything else, just help one another out. And I was called into the service in May of 41. I was called in for 1 year. They were
you went in as an officer then?
Calling back. Reservists for 1 year of active duty.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, December 7th of that year,
Pearl Harbor
attack, and so I was separated then in January 46. So almost 5 years, about 4 years, you know, 9 months, 4 years, and 8 months, or something like that, of active duty. And I had an opportunity to stay in the service. In fact, they asked me to stay in. I was in Little Rock, Arkansas. While I was in the service, I started off in the anti-aircraft artillery and stationed in Camp Davis, North Carolina, which is no longer in existence. And from there, we went to Trinidad. And I was in Trinidad a year and a half. We actually were set up, even though we were anti-aircraft, we were set up as a submarine defense as well, because there were these submarines that the Germans had sank. The Germans sank five ships in the harbor of Port Spain just several weeks before we were sent down there. And so I was there a year and a half, and then from there went to Puerto Rico for 6 months, and then back to the States. And when I got back to the States, I went to Camp Stewart, which is Fort Stewart now, up here in Georgia. And then I went to Augusta, Georgia, short period, and then from there to Little Rock.
So you were in for about 5 years altogether.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed on your Vita that you went from anti-aircraft to the infantry.
Right. When I came back to the States from in Puerto Rico, there were several of us that were sent back to train Puerto Ricans in anti-aircraft artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And when the air war was just about over, so they sent those of us who were in Puerto Rico back to the States, and we were training infantry troops. And we were assigned to infantry, an infantry unit, to train the troops who were coming back from Europe, to train them into jungle warfare for the Pacific. And then as the war kind of wound down, we were in the process of closing the various camps, and that's why I was moved to Augusta, and then from there to Little Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to establish a permanent unit at Little Rock, and then the commanding officer asked me if I would stay in until 1947, June 1947. And I was married in 1944, July 15th, 1944. And my wife was pregnant. We weren't getting the assistance that the medical assistance that we needed there. So I told the commanding officer that I would stay under certain conditions. One of them was I could bring my wife back to Florida, where she could be taken care of. I wanted to go to Loxahatchee and see about the business down there.
Right.
And also, there's one specific job I wanted. There were three positions open, and I wanted one of them.
And this was in.
So
the job you wanted was in. In Loxahatchee?
No, in the Army.
Oh, in the Army. Okay, I'm sorry, I follow you now.
No, and so they agreed, the commanding officer agreed to that. I was talking to the executive officer, and he said that to ensure the commanding officer would agree to it. So I had my 15 days leave to come back and do all of this. And got to Loxahatchee, and I found out there wasn't much of my business left, and all my equipment had gone to pot, because in that climate down there, things don't stand up too well.
So right.
Things were pretty well shot. So I decided, well, I'll just go ahead and stay in the service. And on the way back, I stopped by Gainesville. Just, I don't know why, I just wanted to look around. I heard about the university.
Uh-huh.
Look around. I happened by over here in front of Reed Lab. And I had my uniform on, and I met a gentleman out front, and he asked if he could help me, and I told him, no, I'm looking around. He introduced himself, and he was Professor Clifford Williams, who was the department head of civil engineering at that time. And he asked me what I planned to do after I got out of the service, and I said, well, I kind of made up my mind I was going to stay in. And he said, well, if I tell you, he said, and I'd mentioned that I had done a little civil engineering building in Palm Beach County and irrigation, things like that. Also did some road building in the service and some other civil engineering work, building of bomb shelters and things like that. So he said, well, if you decide you might like to come back to school, he said, why don't you come back and talk to us? So I had no idea that I would ever come back. But I got back to Little Rock, and the executive officer came to the office my first day back, and he said, I have some bad news for you. I said, what's that? I said, well, the job that we were holding for you has been given to somebody else. I said, well, am I obligated to stay? He said, no. He said, we couldn't hold to our commitment, and you don't have to stay if you don't want to. That afternoon, I was out of service.
So you resigned.
I got out.
Now, you retired as what rank?
As a captain. I retired as a captain. At that time, they had a deal that you could either take a promotion or you could take a separation pay. And I needed the money more than I needed the promotion, so I took the money. But I did stay active in the reserves, and I was promoted to major in 52 or 53, somewhere around there, and I was promoted to lieutenant colonel in 1960, and retired as a lieutenant colonel for a total 28-year service.
So you resigned then as a captain, but threw your efforts in the reserves?
Well, it's not as separated. Actually, it was separation, not resignation. So you separate, you transferred from the Army into the reserves.
Okay, I understand.
So you just separated from one and moved into the other.
I'm going to ask you to back up just a little bit here because there is some information, other information I'd like to get. You said you were married in what year?
In July 44, July 15th, 1944.
And what was your wife's name, maiden name?
Mildred Louise Bevis, B-E-V-I-S.
Where did you meet your wife?
I met her before I went into the service. However, I was on active duty for a short tour in Jacksonville, for a 2-week tour of duty in 1938.
She a Florida native?
She's a native Floridian. In fact, when she came on campus, when I came back to the campus, in engineering, she was only native-born wife of anybody in the faculty. But she was from West Florida, a little town of Baston, over New Mariana. And I always kid everybody. I tell her, I say it's a suburb of Tuaig, little town of Tuaig, just close by.
Tuaig is sort of a novelty. Now everybody. Sort of a big thing to say that they had been to Tuaig, Florida.
But she was working in Jacksonville, and I met her there. And then after I went into the service, she went to work for Governor Holland in Tallahassee, and she was working for him when we were married.
Where were you married?
In Jacksonville.
In Jacksonville.
I was stationed in Fort Stewart at that time. And we were married in Methodist Church in Jacksonville.
How many children do you have?
I have one boy, one son.
His name is?
Donald Byron.
What does he do now?
He's Deputy Secretary of Education for the state of Pennsylvania.
Okay, we sort of backed up a little bit, but you can go ahead and if you want to now and continue.
Where did we go from here?
Well, we had you went back with the Army and had decided that you didn't want to stay in, and so I'm assuming that at that point then you started thinking about your future and what.
Well, my. First Sergeant knew that I'd had some building experience, and when he heard that I was going to get out of the service, he asked me if I was interested in staying in the construction business. And I said, well, I would think about it. So he wanted me to go down to Texas City, Texas, to talk to his father-in-law, who had 700 or 800 acres of land that he was trying to develop. And so I went down to talk to him, and he said he would supply the property and the money if I could provide the labor and materials to build. He wanted to build 500 houses.
And, quite a subdivision.
So I looked around to see what I could do, and at that time, the government had all the materials tied up. You couldn't buy materials. And There was nobody that wanted to work that wasn't in the service. Yeah. So I just had to give it up. And after that, I decided I'd come back to school. Came over and talked to Professor Williams.
Did he remember you?
Yes, he did. He remembered me. And he sent me over to talk to Dean Wise. And I talked to the dean for a long while. And he asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, I want to come back and study civil engineering. He said, well, you have a degree in mechanical engineering. You'd be better off to get a master's degree in mechanics. I said, no, that's not what I want. And he tried his darndest to talk me into taking mechanical engineering and a master's degree.
I see.
After we talked a long while, he finally said, well, said, we've got what you want. If that's what you, if you want a degree in civil, that's it. So I enrolled then in civil engineering, and in 1947, I got my bachelor's degree in civil and stayed on to do some master's work for my master's, and completed all my academic work. I hadn't finished my thesis when I took a job in Bradenton for Bill Horton and Associates, engineering and architectural firm there. And then Professor Williams called me in July or August of 49 and asked me if I'd like to come back and teach. Told him I needed to think about it. Things weren't going too well for the engineering firm. The job that we had was about completed, and the boss hadn't gotten another one. So,
what kind of work did you do?
I was doing structural engineering. I was a structural engineer. Our first job was a redesign of the first Tampa Bay Bridge, which was never built. The one we designed was never built because cost exceeded the appropriation. And then the next, we had a big job. It was the design of a VA hospital for Gainesville. It was supposed to be out here on Lake Road.
Uh-huh.
And we had completed the design, but Truman wouldn't release the money. So the building was never built. Worked over a year on the job, and
so two designs and
two designs, and neither of them were built. We got paid for them, but they weren't built. Mm-hmm. And so since things were slacking off, I said, "Okay, I'll come back to Gainesville." I started off as an instructor in August of 49.
Now this was just an instructor position.
Yeah.
Right? Tell me just a little bit, if you would, before you go further, about your impressions of Gainesville when you first came in the university. If you can.
Well, it was a nice, quiet little town, a pretty town. The railroad ran down Main Street at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember very distinctly the last train that came through Gainesville before they ceased operation. And in fact, one of my projects in one class that I had, a class of city planning, was to develop a master plan for the city of Gainesville. So I got to know the town pretty well just by working on that project.
Mm-hmm.
People were very friendly. And, the university was, I don't remember how many students, there weren't very many students here.
A lot smaller than it was, is now.
That's right.
Sure.
We liked Gainesville. My wife and I both liked Gainesville. We lived out in Northeast at that time, and a new subdivision.
What was the name of that?
I don't don't know the name of that. I believe they were naming the subdivisions.
Well, I know there's over in that part of town, there's several now that are that were at one time named, and a lot of people aren't even aware of that.
This one could have had a name.
Carroll Estates and those like that.
Could have had a name, but I don't recall that it did have. But in 1959, we moved over where we are now on 17th Terrace, just south of 16th Avenue. And we've always felt that Gainesville's a very friendly town. Got along well with people.
The university itself was a fairly, and I'm speaking now of the faculty, and it was fairly small at that time.
Very small.
You knew most of the people on the faculty?
Most of the faculty, almost all across campus. And this building had not been completed when I came back.
Weil Hall.
Right. We were, civil engineering was over in what we call Reed, well, it's still called Reed Lab. It was a hydraulic, we called it hydraulics lab then. And when I came back, I actually went into the same office that I had as a graduate student. And then we moved over into this building. And Professor Williams said, well, we can give you we can appoint you as an instructor. And so we can't pay you much, but we'll give you a raise the first of the year. And so the first of the year rolled around, and he came down to see me, and he said, well, we can't give you a raise, but we'll give you a promotion. So I was promoted to assistant professor in January of 50.
Can't have the money, you might as well have the title.
Well, I think probably the reason that they did was because I finished my thesis and I got my master's degree January 50 in civil. So that could have been a part of it also.
What did you do your thesis on?
It was buckling of beam flanges, steel beam flanges. Mm-hmm. It was a thesis that with the mathematical capability of the computers today could have been done on a computer in 20 minutes.
But at that time
it was an iterative process that was used to develop a procedure for the design. And so I just had to work with an old Marchant calculator, mechanical calculator. And many a night I sat turning the crank on that calculator to crank out the data.
I can imagine.
But with the capabilities of the computer, that could all be done now, I imagine, in 20 minutes.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It is. It really is. Things that we can do now that we couldn't do 30, 40, 50 years ago.
As a student here, a graduate student, were you impressed with the faculty?
Oh, yes. We had top-notch faculty. The faculty that... the professors that I had... Well, Professor Williams went on. He left here and he established one of the better-known engineering firms in the United States.
What was the name of that?
Patch and Mengeldorf and Williams in Augusta, Georgia. And then we had Professor Paquette, who left here and went to Georgia Tech.
Spell his name for me.
P-A-Q-U-E-T-T-E, I believe.
Okay.
And Ritter, who left here and worked with the Army and Navy developing educational material. And Romolo, who went out as dean at Mexico, I believe. And all of them are top-notch people. I I was very thankful and very fortunate to have good people.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about the facilities at that time, particularly in the College of Engineering?
Well, we didn't have too much in the way of... In fact, we didn't have much space then. We had Walker Hall and there's another one over there right next to Walker.
Well, it's a building where Grinter is now that was later raised. But that was not...
That was a part of the engineering. In fact, mechanical engineering was in that, and the mechanical engineering shops were right in the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the hydraulics laboratory over here, and that was about it. That was all we had in the way of engineering space at that time.
Fairly spread out, too, at that.
Yeah. Well, we're just the one
here.
Building, that's all.
Uh-huh.
But, like I said, the whole campus, we were on the edge of the campus. The railroad track used to come right up here about 40 yards east of us and discharge passengers, discharge football fans.
Was it a spur line?
Spur line that came off. It came off down here, cut around where the hospital is now,
uh-huh.
and came up alongside material science over here. And it was used to bring coal into the power plant, which used to be right next to us here.
Mm-hmm.
And also it used to bring passengers in here from Jacksonville and Tampa, I guess. Football games on the weekend.
Can't forget those Gator fans.
Nope. when I was a graduate student here, it said I was a superintendent of construction on a pilot, a sewer treatment pilot plant. The sewage treatment system for the whole campus consisted of what they call an IMHOFF tank.
Spell that for me.
IMHOFF. And the sewage is dumped in and it digests, and the effluent, the liquid portions of it is taken off the top. And
sort of like a septic tank works.
It's like a big septic tank. And it... was down here just south of mechanical engineering in the woods. And at that time, this was while I was in graduate school, there was Dr. Black, who was a chemist. A chemist discovered a strange bug in the water here on campus. And they didn't know where it was coming from. So they asked me to take a liter of very concentrated dye and put into a sinkhole, which was down here below the incinerator. You know where the incinerator is?
It's right behind Wild Hall here, just...
Well,
isn't it?
No, it's behind... you know where Black Hall, Black Lab is?
Right, I know where that is.
Just down the hill from there.
Okay.
Well, just over that hill there was a sinkhole. So I took a liter of dye and dumped in there one night at 5 o'clock. And the next morning it showed up in the city water. And this was where all of the effluent from this IMHOFF tank was flowing.
Right into the city water.
So what we were doing is we were just recirculating our sewage, and it was most of it being used here on campus, I think, because I lived in Flavette Village, which used to be right over here.
Right.
This side of the student union. And there was a very high concentration of bug in that.
Now, when you say bug, you're talking about some
bacteria,
sort of bacteria.
Right.
Right.
And bacteria that was indicative of human
excrement,
right. So the water over there tasted like chlorine for several months. They weren't satisfied with the dye experiment, so a couple of days later I dumped a ton of salt. And this was they decided they would do to try to be sure that this was where the...
if the water came out salty.
And I dumped it in about 5 o'clock one night, and about 4 o'clock the next morning, the salt content of the water went up appreciably.
Okay, you were telling me that the salt content went up, and that eventually satisfied them to the fact that they needed to build a new sewage.
Well, they needed to do something to keep this effluent from going into the
city water,
into the subterranean cavities that fed the city water pumps. So it was decided as a temporary measure to divert the material from the old Imhoff tank over to the job that we were building, over to the pilot plant. And so I had to run a line from the Imhoff tank over to a tank that was this side of the now existing black lab. And there was a big magnolia tree that was in the way of a direct line. Dr. Tigard was president at that time, and Dr. Tigard had a rule that nobody cut a tree on this campus without his permission. And I didn't know about it. And so I told him to cut the tree. It was about almost dead anyway. So I told the workman, I said, go ahead and cut the tree down. But you know, before they get that tree down, I got a call from Dr. Tigard.
He already had gotten wind of it.
And so I had to stop. And he came over and said, you can't cut that tree. You'll have to go around it. So I had to put a bend around that tree. And I'd like to say it died about completely about 2 years later.
Had they already started cutting the tree?
They had were just about ready to start. But Dr. Tigard heard about it. I don't know how he heard about it. Don't have any idea.
He had someone.
But he had his grapevine working, I tell you. But we diverted the sewage then over to that plant, and while they were building the new plant over there, that's in operation now. But that was the way I paid my way, part of the way I paid my way through school.
Was working.
After the Army. And we ought to get back to my first few years here.
Then you came back here as an instructor.
Instructor, and then 3 months later, promoted to assistant professor. And I was teaching structural engineering courses, steel design, and indeterminate structures. Mostly, it was amusing. In a way, it was rather frustrating for me, because here I was trying to teach people that I'd been sitting next to in class just the year before. And they would do everything in the world to confuse me, and they did plenty of it too.
Sure.
But I think probably it's one of the best learning experiences in being able to stand before a group and think of answers to questions without having to say, well, I'll get that answer for you tomorrow.
I have to look it up in the
book. Boy, I tell you, they really kept me on my toes. Mm-hmm. Those people who had been my classmates just a year before.
Did you enjoy teaching?
Oh, yeah, I liked it very much. I like the students. I like to work with them, see them develop. I still keep track of as many of them as I can, and try to keep up with where they are, see how they're doing.
Mm-hmm. You when you first started teaching, what size classes generally did you have?
About 12 or 15.
Now, these classes that you taught were strictly for civil engineering people? What made you decide to go into civil engineering? You mentioned you had done some work.
Well, it was... I suppose it was because I like to see things, like to design things and then see them built.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in mechanical, you didn't have that.
Well, you could... When I studied mechanical, I had the wrong concept really of what mechanical engineering was. My dad graduated as a mechanical, but he actually worked as much as a civil as he did a mechanical. And I thought when he designed and built one of the mills for the firm that he was working for, I thought he was doing mechanical as a 10, 11, or 12 year old kid. I didn't know the difference. And since I enjoyed listening to him and watching what he did and seeing things that he did as a part of his job, I said, well, that's what I want to do.
So he then was your major influence.
That's
in
deciding right. He's
what
the
to
one
do.
Even as a kid, the gang I ran around with, I couldn't say a gang, there were only five of us, three brothers and one family, and my brother and myself. We were always pretending we were building things.
Mm-hmm.
Damming creeks and we'd build ourselves a cabin along the river and things of this nature, and it's just a natural interest, I think, in building things. And then when I took the job as a mechanical engineer with the New Jersey Zinc Company, the last job I had with them was a civil engineering job. It was mm-hmm. Building a zinc refining plant. And just the idea of taking a concept and seeing it grow and then see something result from it. Either a road or a building or some sort of a plant or a sewage treatment plant or mm-hmm. something like that. And it's just something that I've always liked to do.
And you felt that with civil you could,
could
you
do
have
that better
more of an opportunity
than,
of
than
doing
anything
that
else. Well, while I was at VPI, I took a lot of different courses. I had almost enough credits to graduate at the end of my junior year, but they weren't in
the right areas.
Enough area. I took courses in industrial and aeronautical and surveying, which I wasn't required to take. But most of them were, courses were mechanical, so I decided that my senior year, since I was farther along with mechanical than any other, I'd go ahead and finish there. But the job I liked best immediately after school was working on that, the construction of that zinc refining plant.
Mm-hmm.
And if it hadn't been so cold, I'd have stayed there.
Tell me just a little bit about what a civil engineer does. If, for instance, I come to you and I say, I'm going to build a whatever, a factory or whatever. Tell me just a little bit, what would a civil engineer do at that point?
Well, to go back and history a little bit. At one time there were only military engineers, and the Romans were the great engineers of their day, and it was only until about 1790 or thereabouts that anybody called themselves a civil engineer. gentleman in England built hundreds of miles of canals, and he was the first person to call himself a civil engineer. Now, civil engineering then was the term that distinguished between those who did military works and those who did civil works. And it wasn't until about 1860 or 70 that people began to differentiate between engineering for the civil populace. They were all civil engineers up until that time, and then the field became, the field of knowledge grew, then the mechanicals and electricals and industrials all broke off, and the so-called founders societies, the mechanical, electrical, civil, chemical, and industrial, were the major engineering disciplines. But they all came initially from civil engineering. And so what has developed over the years is that where we had everything at one time, when somebody would break off, we were left with all the rest of it. And today, the civil engineer is more involved with public works projects probably than anything else. They design bridges, buildings, transmission towers, power plants, dams, highways, transportation mm-hmm. systems, things of that nature, and water and sewer plants, coastal structures. Until recently, well, at the University of Florida, for example, when I first came here in 1949, mm-hmm. Coastal engineering, which was very small at that time, engineering mechanics, environmental engineering were all civil engineering. Now, over the years, they have broken away mm-hmm. from civil. Now, they are still classified as civil engineers, even though they are separate departments. I say they're classified as civil, the broad scope
is civil.
They fall under a broad scope of civil engineering, even though they do call themselves coastal engineers and environmental engineers and engineering mechanics. The engineering mechanics discipline. But the civil engineers are principally designers and builders. Construction is one of the major areas of civil engineering. And so it's a very broad field. In fact, the American Society of Civil Engineers is broken up into 17 divisions. Different areas of interest. Now, many of them are in the hydraulics area mm-hmm. because we have one area that's what we call pipelines, which are design and construction of pipelines like the Alaskan pipeline and mm-hmm. some water lines, or the oil line that goes from Kuwait into Turkey, and there are great water systems in South America and in California, pipeline systems that they pipe water all the way from Northern California down into Central and Southern California. And then they have the canals, and the coastal is also a part of the hydraulics. So even within the specific areas, there is a division. Mm-hmm. And then we have structural engineering, which is the design and construction of bridges and buildings. And transportation, which is the design of transportation systems, highways, rail, airports,
What area do you fit in?
Structural. That's my principal area. Although, since I've been here, I've taught just about every course that we have had in the past, including one environmental course, which I was never very good at. Mm-hmm. But I got stuck with it one year when one of the professors was away. But I like the design and the construction of bridges and buildings. That's my principle. Be using steel, timber, and concrete.
All three materials.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about some of the projects that you were involved with in addition to your teaching work at the university. I know one of the things I noticed was that you were involved with building Fuller Warren Bridge. Is that correct?
This was one of Professor Williams' projects. It was a job that was contracted by Rennell Smith and Hills in Jacksonville. And Rennell Smith and Hills hired Professor Williams to do the structural portion of that Fort Warren Bridge. And Professor Williams hired a number of us graduate students to do the calculations on that bridge, and that was my involvement with that. The concept was already there. All we did was just do the calculations to fasten the members together, select the member sizes and fasten the members together, do some of the analysis, initially.
Just to make sure everything was going to work.
Right.
I had noticed that on there, and that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. Did you have any other special projects that you were involved in?
Well, I worked a little bit, but not a great deal on the first Tampa Bay Bridge that, as I said, was never built. And then one summer I worked on the business administration building here as a structural engineer. I don't recall any big job, any other big jobs I've worked on. Most of them have been fairly small. I did work on the first five 707s that were built.
Oh, really?
With
Boeing?
Boeing. I worked one summer with Boeing, and during that summer we were building the first five 707s. I was with what they called the Engineering and Manufacturing Liaison Group, which was responsible for taking those things that didn't work during the assembly of the airplane and finding out why they didn't and recommending ways to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very interesting job.
Obviously,
I worked on every part, I think, of that airplane.
Obviously, it must have been successful.
It's probably one of the most successful airplanes we've ever built.
Yes, that's true.
And
this was, you did this during the summers?
Yeah.
Between teaching and...
Right. Well, when... The first, 8 or 10 years I was with the university, everybody's on a 12-month contract. And we had 1 month's vacation per year. And we could accumulate that for 2 years and then take the whole summer off with pay.
I see.
And at that time, the aircraft industry was trying to convince graduates that they ought to go to work for the aircraft industry. The federal government was putting a lot of money into aircraft, and so they were inviting professors out to work with the aircraft companies so that they could come back and tell the students what kind of work the aircraft companies did. And I got the best job that anybody could have gotten. But some of the rest of them were just jobs where you put in time and didn't do much. Uh-huh. But
but you really enjoyed yours.
I enjoyed it. I feel like I felt like I made a contribution. I learned a lot, and I think I helped a great deal.
Did you ever feel like maybe leaving the university and going into that?
No, not really.
You enjoyed it, but not that much.
My only inclination to leave was when Professor Williams, after he left, offered me a job in structural engineering, and I decided against it after talking with the department chairman. And then there was another one of our graduates who was a very successful structural engineer in Tampa that asked me to go work with him. And I seriously considered that for a while. And some personal problems came up that prevented me from doing that.
It must be kind of gratifying to have one of your own students leave and become so successful.
Well, it is.
I don't think enough of you do.
Well, I've had a couple of them that have done that. None of them quite as successful as this individual was.
What firm was he?
Watson & Company in Tampa. Mm-hmm. In fact, he's probably a millionaire several times over. He always tells me, say, if you'd come to work for me, you'd have been a millionaire too.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I'd have been happy.
Well, they say that most people that go into academia and into teaching, they don't go into it for the money.
I like to teach. I got a lot of fun out of it. And to see them make a success of themselves, that's a real pleasure.
Tell me a little bit about, I noticed another thing that you've been involved with quite a bit was the construction, of course this would have been in the early 60s, but the construction of fallout shelters and that sort of thing. What was your involvement in that?
Well, back when Russia was talking about putting missiles into Cuba, I thought they were going to put the atomic bomb in there. And, so the Department of Defense at that time started a program on fallout shelter design and construction. And so I decided I would attend a training course in that, and was convinced that there was a place for fallout shelters, that they could be effective if you could convince people to build them and use them.
Of course, during that time, and I'm speaking a little bit here from personal experience, because I can remember as a kid, everybody, especially during the missile crisis,
1961, yeah,
shelters.
Everybody, everybody was looking for protection. I say everybody, not everybody. There were a number of people who said, well, if it involves the atomic bomb, there's no use in even trying to protect yourself. But studies had shown that while there would be considerable devastation and quite a long recovery period, that if you did protect enough people, that the nation could survive. And so I started then with several others here on campus, Professor Donald Sawyer and Professor King Royer from Building Construction, and then we had a couple of people from Architecture. And so we started putting on these courses, and we taught these courses all over Florida.
Were these courses that anyone could attend, or was this something?
Mostly engineers and architects.
So
you had to have some technical background because we started off with atomic physics.
They weren't simply what I'm saying. They weren't courses for the layman who would want to go out and
construct a fallout shelter. Go out and talk to people. If we were asked, the Kiwanis or some civic
Club
organization,
yep.
we did a lot of that. But the only thing I list there is the technical work. And the unfortunate part of it was, and I told them at the very beginning, I said, you're never going to sell the American public on fallout shelters. What we ought to do is attack it from the standpoint of natural disaster. Because the same thing that protects against fallout, I mean, same thing that protects against wind, earthquake, and flood will protect against fallout. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we want to concentrate on fallout, because that's the thing that is in the forefront right now. And as the threat seemed to die off, then they did go into the natural disaster. That's what they teach now, is natural disaster courses. And, from the fallout shelter, we did go into blast shelters, and we did quite a bit of work with municipalities in the design of communications centers, which were bomb-proof. I should say bomb-proof, bomb-resistant.
Yeah.
Because you never make them bomb-proof. If you dropped an atomic bomb right on top of one of them, I don't think it would survive.
I think perhaps that's a lot of people's misconception, too, that you were saying earlier, that people say, well, the atomic bomb, there's no way we can protect against it. But obviously what you're talking about with fallout shelters is something that's not going to be involved in a direct hit.
Well, and also they don't realize that the fallout doesn't spread equally in all directions. It'll follow a path downwind, and there's only a certain area that's affected. And also the radiation dies out after a period of time, and at that time the feeling was that if you stayed in a shelter for 2 weeks, that you could come out and stay out for a period of time. You'd have to use a shelter for some considerable period of time, but you could at least come out for a short period of time. But so many people, particularly older people, say, well, I'm too old to worry about that. The bomb, there's nothing you can do about it. Everybody's going to be dead. That's sort of attitude. And there was not only a job of teaching design, but it was a selling job too. I'm trying to convince people that what we were doing was worthwhile.
I know a lot of buildings you go into nowadays, even you see signs up if the building has a basement, the old sign is still there. Is that was that something that you tried to sell to people who were designing buildings at that time, that this was a need to
all federal buildings had to be designed with a certain amount of shelter in them. Also, the federal government would pay those of us who were trained in shelter design. Those people that we trained would pay them to make the surveys for public buildings if the owners of those buildings requested it. Mm-hmm. All of the federal, well, many of the state buildings had to be were required to be designed as fallout shelters, or have space to accommodate a certain number of people. It's probably still in effect, but nobody pays any attention to it.
Yeah.
Because it isn't considered a threat anymore. In fact, I just saw in the paper this morning where $1 billion radar system in New England is going to be operated only 40 hours a week now in order to save money.
Because there's such this with the,
well, because of the
Cold War,
Cold War
coming
War,
to an yeah. end. Yeah, it's amazing to, you know, as I said, I can think when I was young and remember the sort of the frenzy that everyone was in to build fallout shelters and to make sure that they had provisions stored and that sort of thing. It really seems kind of foreign to us now.
Mm-hmm.
to think that we were, that we felt that way, but.
Like we still have hurricanes, tornadoes.
Well, that was.
Things like that we need to concern ourselves with, and.
That was going to be my next question, because I noticed that you, it was that sort of a natural movement then to you from the fallout shelters into other sort of disaster preparedness?
That, and that's why I finally got into my interest in, well, I've always been interested in design for wind forces, but even more so after I got into the fallout shelter and blast design, because I could see where they all work together.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that we were having problems with construction along the shores. People building with improper foundations, the structures that were not wind resistant.
Now this was what period? Pre?
Well, I actually started in this about 1975. And it started with an investigation of the damage by Hurricane Eloise in Panama City. Dr. Self, who was a member of our staff until a couple of years ago, and I did an evaluation of the structural damage at Panama City Beach after that storm. 12-mile stretch of beach line. And so that was the coastal protection interest was a spinoff from the fallout and blast shelter design. But like I say, they do the same things are effective in against them all.
So wind then affects a structure in much the same way
as
the blast
except
would.
If the magnitude of it is considerably greater. And
with the blast or with the wind?
The blast is considerably greater, yeah.
Okay.
However, the thing that we need for resistance to wind contributes also to resistance to fallout. The radiation from fallout. So they're all doing the same thing.
Everything's interrelated then, and you've got sort of a natural crossover between the two.
Yeah.
I noticed that some of you had done some writing on particularly on hurricanes and. In coastal areas.
This is a result of the investigations that Dr. Self and I did, and then I had a research project to evaluate structures in the Keys for resistance to wave forces in that area, because along the coast, wave forces are more damaging than the wind forces. And since the Keys are so low in elevation, in a storm like the 25 storm, you practically cover the whole island, all of the islands down there.
With the storm surge.
Yeah. So we were asked to go down, and this was a federal combination federal and county project. The National Science Foundation paid for part of it, and the Monroe County paid for part of it. And Chris Jones, who was with Coastal Engineering, and I did the evaluation of about 50 structures in the Keys to determine the resistance, determine which would be good shelters in case of a severe storm, 150 mile an hour storm, which would bring the water pretty high on the Keys.
Mm-hmm. Do you, in your opinion, I know with the growth of Miami area and then that whole part of the coast along there. In your opinion, do you think that we're in much danger?
Oh, I know. We still do not build adequate structures. The last structure I looked at was about several years ago now, but it was over in Destin Beach. And that building is not built to resist tidal action, the wave action.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid that if we get the right kind of a storm there, that building will collapse.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me. I think people forget the power of hurricanes. I was through the Charleston area, well, not actually Charleston, but went up the interstate shortly after Hugo went through, and it was just amazing to me the destruction, and this was 3 or 4 months later, that was still evident from that storm. And I think that you're right. I don't think that there's an appreciation, particularly along the southeast coast.
Well, the thing that bothers me is that the National Science Foundation puts so much money into research for earthquake resistance, and you consider the dollar value of the damage in the last earthquake in California compared to Hugo, and Hugo was far greater in terms of dollars and damage, and still you can't get National Science Foundation to put money into that kind of research, and it's a shame.
Why do you think that there's a differentiation made?
I don't know. Maybe they make more noise than we do. I attended a conference, spoke at a conference, and gave a paper at the conference on resistance of timber elements to earthquakes, and this was a symposium that was supposed to develop research programs, and I tried to bring out in my paper and in my discussions with those people out there that we're talking about wind forces here as much as we are earthquakes, and we need to put some money into it, but there was nobody else out there but me who was interested in wind forces. Money still went to earthquakes.
Well, I think the country, not the whole country, but a certain part, seems to have a preoccupation with the West Coast anyway. And I think perhaps that's part of it.
If people would just look back in history at some of the hurricanes we've had in New Jersey, New England, Hugo, and coastal Florida, and all around Alabama, Louisiana, and Texas, they realize that we have more problems with hurricanes than we do with earthquakes. But nobody wants to sit back and look at it. I don't know. There's another fellow in I in town, and another fellow in Miami, and I have done a lot of talking. But
who is that person?
I'll think of his name in a minute.
I never can
remember his name, but he's a real good friend of mine, and I'm his Herb Saffir. Herb S-A-F-F-I-R. Herb uh-huh. Saffir. He's much more of an expert in the area than I am, but we just can't seem to convince anybody that. Well, we have, along with the coastal engineering and some of the other engineers in the state, we did finally get a law passed that required certain considerations if you build within a certain distance of the coast, the coastal setback line law, as it's coastal construction law, they call it. But even that has been watered down because the contractor say it costs too much money. I don't know why they say it, because it doesn't cost that much money. It doesn't cost more than 1 or 2% more to build a good structure than it does to build the kind of structures that they're building. But the builders have a lobby in Tallahassee, and they're the ones that can get things done. At one time, we had 145 mile an hour design requirement. 140, 145, I've forgotten which. A lot of engineers feel should be the design win. And the contractors have cut it back to 115.
It's not a very strong hurricane. Not on a coastal area, anyway.
Well, that's the thing people don't understand. They don't realize that there's nothing that slows a hurricane down until it hits the coast.
Right.
And that's where we need the protection. Nobody wants to recognize it.
Well, and then the